Haley was really trying out for a place on the board of some defense contractor. It was a very aggressive hit, and one that I think was notable because it gets to, I think, a lot of the deep divisions within the Republican Party about foreign policy. I wish that the moderators had really played this out a little more and given more time to a deeper investigation of this. And I think it's especially notable that DeSantis was desperately trying to get into the discussion, but came in not with, with particularly deep insights, but just a repetition of talking points about the border.
John Nichols, I want to thank you for being with us, the nation's national affairs correspondent. We'll link to your latest piece, The Party of the Big Lie and the Even Bigger Lie. This all on the eve of President Trump turning himself in. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's about to get an infusion of emergency cash due to one of the most recent wildfires to provoke evacuations. A town hall about the environment brings lots of questions from Oregonians about safe and clean air and water. And an orca from the Pacific Northwest dies after people tried to save her from captivity. We have a special commentary.
Toki, also known by her performing name Lolita and her indigenous name Skalichochtonal.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 24th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has authorized Oregon's request for money to help with the firefighting costs for the Liberty Fire burning in Marion County, Oregon. The regional administrator determined the fire threatened to cause such destruction as would constitute a major disaster. At the time of the state's request, the wildfire threatened hundreds of homes where people had to evacuate in the communities of Liberty, South Salem, and Salem Hills. The fire also threatened buildings, roads, bridges, public power, and utilities in the area. This is the second time this year that Oregon has received a fire management assistance grant through the President's Disaster Relief Fund. The money can pay for items like field camps, equipment use, repair and replacement, tools, supplies, and mobilization activities, and can cover 75% of a state's firefighting costs. They do not provide help for homeowners or business owners for damage from fires. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has been warning people this would be a tough wildfire season.
Some regions have experienced persistent severe droughts, particularly in eastern Oregon, where fire indices suggest an above average fire season. There are several challenges facing us, including capacity in rural areas that largely rely on volunteer fire services. But it's going to be up to every single one of us, every Oregonian, to do our part to prevent human-caused fires before they start. Prepare your yard. Have an evacuation plan. Have a to-go kit. Have a plan if there is smoke in your community.
And that's Oregon Governor Tina Kotek. From wildfires to clean air and water, issues about environmental health impact all of our lives in Oregon. The Oregon League of Conservation Voters this week held a town hall on the environment featuring Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. Here are some of the highlights.
This is a perfect opportunity to take stock of the first anniversary of the legislation. The clean energy tax credits, I worked on them for something like 8 years. It's the biggest investment in fighting climate change in the country's history. And obviously, we've got something to celebrate. We ought to recognize we've got a tremendous amount more to do. We also have a chance for another couple of historic wins, particularly in the Oahe and with the River Democracy Act. And this August, suffice it to say, again, demonstrates the painful realities of the climate crisis and kind of all of the ways in which we're going to respond. And I think alarm bells are ringing very strongly right now with respect to what the task is at hand. I was in Lane County yesterday, and people basically said the folks there have their go bags ready to go because they could have to evacuate at any time. So what we tried to do was break 40 years worth of gridlock. It was hard on climate to do it with a regulatory kind of approach. It was hard to do it with cap and trade. It was hard to do it with carbon taxes. And I said, I'm a junior member on the finance committee. I'm sitting on the mother load. And that is using these ridiculous tax provisions, most of which subsidized fossil fuel policies from yesteryear. They were contrary to everything we needed to do in terms of renewables, because most of them had a shelf life shorter than a carton of eggs. So there was no predictability and no certainty and the like. So we spent a big chunk of time building a different kind of future, saying that we could take some bold steps in transportation and clean energy and energy efficient homes. And all of that has paid off, because in the committee, we thought we might generate about $370 billion worth of clean energy investments. And it looks like there's a decent chance to double that. So clearly, the markets are responding in a positive way with respect to solar and wind and renewables and hydro. And that's some very good news. Back east, they call it Oregon's version of the Grand Canyon, and that's the Oahe. And thanks for the terrific art that you all are putting together that is really going to give people all over Oregon and hopefully in the country a chance to see what we're up to. And what's historic about this is we got the conservation community and the ranchers together. And we all remember the inimitable, legendary Mary Gautreaux. And this legislation, this agreement, has her name all over it. And I'm sure Mary is going to lift a crystal champagne flute in heaven when we get this passed. While we're talking about champagne flutes in heaven, with the River Democracy Act, this is the first ever bill to empower grassroots leaders to decide what kinds of provisions they wanted for our treasured waters. We went all over the state. OLCV was very constructive in terms of helping us get the input and the emails and the phone calls and the public forums and the virtual town halls. And what an Oregon Way process. 15,000 individual nominations, 3,215 miles of designated rivers and streams, all with the goals of making sure we have clean drinking water for Oregonians, that we preserve our fishing, that we preserve our recreation economy. If this bill's proposed rivers and streams were laid end to end, it would stretch from Astoria on the Oregon coast all the way to Boston Harbor. So let me use that little bit of politics, geography, and math all as a kind of opening salvo from my end, Lindsay, but just thanks for your good work and for all the grassroots effort, because OLCD has long demonstrated that political change hardly ever starts in government buildings and trickles down. It's almost always just the other way. It's bottoms up. So it's great to work with y'all.
Well, it's great to have you. And as you already listed out a few of the things that, you know, why we're so fortunate to have you as our senior senator here in Oregon, really are a champion for both fighting climate change. And also, I think we're excited to talk to you more about some of the conservation-focused efforts that you're leading on, like River Democracy Act and protecting the Oahe Canyonlands. So, I mean, we got lots of questions. We have Westland City Councilor Scott Irwin.
Well, thank you very much for doing this, OLCV, and thank you very much for taking the time to be here, Senator. So I am a city councilor here in Westland, and just, I'm sure some people know, but just run down, it's about 30,000 people. We have a very small commercial and industrial tax base, so it's mostly residential here. We're wondering, what tangible things can a municipality of our size or even smaller do that would not require a large investment of funds or a large amount of time on behalf of any city staff?
It's an important question, Scott, and what I set out to do was to make sure that small and medium-sized cities that are such an important part of the country, both substantively in terms of quality of life and politically in terms of their voice, would have a chance to be heard. And in the tax provisions of the IRA, we were able to make sure that there would be direct cash payments, what is called direct pay for clean energy tax credits, including electric and hybrid vehicles, mobile machinery, rooftop solar, and geothermal heat pumps. So this is needed because cities and municipalities of a different kind of tax kind of configuration don't pay taxes directly. And so this is a direct pay mechanism. There's no cap. As long as a city meets the qualifications, it can get up to a 30% refund on much of these investments. So for all of those municipalities who are interested in direct pay, we're available to help. We believe that direct pay to local municipalities is an affordable way that small communities can make a really big difference. And you and other local officials are always the first to hear from community folks when something goes wrong. This is a chance to be a messenger for something that's going to go right. And we're getting good reviews so far, and we look forward to working with you guys on it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the great question. One of the things I love about, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act is how much I've already seen such connection, federal, state, and local. So I thought that was a great representation of that happening. Now we're going to go to Keith Wilson.
Senator Wyden, good afternoon. Good to see you again, sir. As the chairman of the Senate's Finance Committee, thanks for your extraordinary work as one of the Inflation Reduction Act's lead architects and proponents of the single largest investment in climate and clean energy in American history.
Keith, I'm glad you've said it in such a complimentary way. There was a publication a couple of days ago that said I was the godfather of the Inflation Reduction Act, and my wife called up and said, oh, I was just wondering if that's a good thing.
Well done, sir. It's a huge compliment to you, and I've been following your leadership through the process as well. Specifically, this new legislation will provide up to $40,000 credit for the replacement of a diesel-powered truck with an electric vehicle. And I have six of them that I just took delivery on and are operating in the streets of Portland. I do owe you and your colleagues a huge debt of gratitude for making this milestone possible. I had been following it for years because the cost of an electric truck is three times the cost of a diesel-powered counterpart. How long will the credits provided by the IRA be available? And then second, if the credits are not evergreen, what is the next course of action to ensure clean energy credits are favored over continued fossil fuel tax credits?
First, Keith, thanks very much for inviting me at the unveiling of the first electric freight truck last month, an amazing accomplishment. I wish I could join, but I want to be with you sometime in person and soon. So converting freight trucks to electric is a major aspect of carbon reduction, you know, goals. I think everybody understands that you really can't get on top of this ballgame unless you deal with the transportation sector. And you, Keith, and Titan Freight are the spears, in effect, the tips of that effort. So we're glad you're using it. And the clean commercial vehicle credit from trucks to vans to buses, I think it's going to be a game changer for clean transportation. Now, one of the things that we had to do with the congressional scorekeepers and all the kind of bean counters that they have back there is I wanted to make sure that the bill was permanent, as in totally permanent, as in we don't have to worry about it anymore. The bean counters basically count permanent as 10 years, extending through 2032. And that is permanent under federal tax policy. And obviously, we're just going to keep building on it from this point on at every opportunity.
And that was part of this week's Oregon League of Conservation Voters Town Hall on the environment. As KBOO News reported on Monday, a captive orca from the Pacific Northwest, which performed for more than 50 years in Miami, passed away just as efforts to free her were moving forward. With a commentary on her plight and that of other captive wildlife, here is the host of KBOO's Voices for the Animals, Michelle Coppola.
As you may have heard, Tokate, the Pacific Northwest orca who performed and suffered in captivity for over 50 years at the Miami Seaquarium, died last Friday. Toki, also known by her performing name Lolita and her indigenous name Skalichochtonal, was one of many young orcas violently captured in Puget Sound back in 1970. She would spend the next 5 decades in a small tank performing tricks in order to get fed. She was retired about a year ago and moved to another small, barren, and at times filthy tank out of public view. It was there that this majestic, social orca remained virtually alone until she passed last Friday, just as plans to return her to her home waters in Washington State were moving forward. Personally, I think nothing illustrates the darker parts of human nature more than the fact that around the world, wild animals are still sentenced to a lifetime of mental and/or physical torture for our amusement and entertainment. But there is something you can do to end this senseless cruelty. It's very easy and completely effortless. You can stop supporting animal-based entertainment and tourism. Say no to SeaWorld, Marineland, and parks like it. Say no to swimming with dolphins, riding elephants, taking pictures with tiger babies. Say no to circuses and shows that use wild animals. And yes, this includes saying no to zoos, who, regardless of what they tell you about their education and conservation efforts, are still money-making ventures that profit off of animal suffering. Zoos are also mandated by the organization that accredits them to try and breed animals in captivity that will never know freedom, even though every instinct in their body tells them that they don't belong where they are. It won't cost you anything, and saying no to animal tourism and entertainment will keep money out of the pockets of people who profit from using wild animals as tourist attractions. Eventually, these people will find another way to survive. Unlike wild animals, who have no choice about anything when we capture, forcibly breed, and exploit them, all just for our amusement.
When a train derailed in February at East Palestine, Ohio, 20 of its cars contained hazardous chemicals. Now, as Brett Pevito reports, researchers are studying the impact on cancer and other diseases.
The Healthy Futures Research Project is seeking participants from the area who were subjected to chemical exposure in the aftermath of the train accident. The team from Case Western Reserve University will look at short and long-term health issues, including screening for cancer as well as metabolic and autoimmune diseases. Lead researcher Dr. Frederick Schumacher says the team will measure DNA damage to examine health impacts over the longer term.
We've got a lot of personal stories, things that affected them directly at the moment from either the burn or the initial exposure, you know, skin irritants and difficulty breathing and others. And now we just want to kind of get an objective biomarker, such as the DNA, to look at that long-term risk.
The study is still enrolling. The February 3rd accident and subsequent burn-off released multiple hazardous chemicals into the air. Schumacher says conducting health impact studies on chemical exposure is complicated in this instance by the number of chemicals involved.
The problem that we saw was measuring one chemical is you have to kind of then know which chemical to test for, and then you don't understand necessarily the effects if they're put into a mixture, and then you may not even understand the effects when they're put into a mixture and only partially combusted versus fully combusted.
Schumacher says oftentimes people see cancer as an endpoint when a person develops a tumor or they don't, but he says researchers are now looking at disease risk as a spectrum where risk profiles change with the level or frequency of exposure.
So if you kind of think about every time you do something from smoking to not exercising to eating poorly, you're kind of raising that risk for disease. So we're trying to understand if we can begin to measure that spectrum so that we then can maybe develop interventions that would allow people to go back the other way.
Researchers are also assembling a community advisory board to help with participant recruitment and advocacy efforts.
One out of every 5 women in the U.S. report they were mistreated during maternity care, At the same time, the CDC reported the maternal death rate in the U.S. rose from 2018 to 2021. As Mark Richardson reports, women from ethnic groups including Native Americans, African Americans, and Hispanics are more likely to have negative experiences with health care during pregnancy and delivery that impact their quality of care and their health outcomes.
A report by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that about 30% of Black, Hispanic, and multiracial women reported mistreatment compared to 20% overall while obtaining maternity care. Shanna Cox, the CDC's Associate Director for Science in the Division of Reproductive Health, says many of the women surveyed reported similar experiences when visiting a hospital or clinic.
Receiving no response to requests for help, being shouted or scolded at, which can be termed as, you know, verbal abuse, not having their physical privacy protected, and being threatened with withholding treatment or made to accept unwanted treatment.
Cox says they learned from the survey that almost half of all pregnant women said they shied away from asking questions or sharing concerns about their pregnancy or delivery. Many women say they were embarrassed to ask a question, felt their health care provider would think they were being difficult, or they did not feel confident that they knew what they were talking about. Cox says better communication is necessary.
Some of this information was precipitated by some of the work that we do with the Hear Her campaign, which is a campaign that we hope to promote awareness of the urgent maternal warning signs and promote provider and patient communication.
He says healthcare systems need to provide respectful care, consider the patient's values, needs, and desires, and ensure patients are engaged in their healthcare and feel heard and respected.
Some of this information was precipitated by some of the work that we do with the Hear Her campaign, which is a campaign that we hope to promote awareness of the urgent maternal warning signs and promote provider and patient communication.
I'm Mark Richardson.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clouds roll in, a low of 66. Tomorrow's weather, sunny skies, a high of 93. Today in history, on this date in 79 AD, Mount Vesuvius erupted in southern Italy, devastating the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum and killing thousands of people. The quote of the day is from Pliny the Younger, who witnessed the eruption and survived. He wrote, "A dark and horrible cloud charged with combustible matter suddenly broke and set forth. Some bewailed their own fate, others prayed to die." Rudy Giuliani surrenders at the Fulton County Jail. Republican presidential hopefuls debate with Trump notably absent. And protest signs are allowed in the Tennessee Statehouse after a judge blocked a new GOP rule. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Rudy Giuliani was one of three key election lawyers for former President Donald Trump who surrendered Wednesday at the Fulton County Jail over charges tied to their attempts to assist Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Giuliani is charged with 13 crimes and called the indictment a travesty. Lawyer Sidney Powell faces 7 state charges and Jenna Ellis faces 2. Meanwhile, requests by former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and ex-Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark to extend the deadline to turn themselves in were denied by the judge, who said 2 weeks was ample time. Several Republican presidential hopefuls took to the stage Wednesday for their first debate in Milwaukee. Republican Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene rejected them all to support former President Donald Trump.
I was surprised that I didn't know who the governor of North Dakota and some other people were. They really don't have a chance because America knows what we had 4 years with President Trump.
Trump opted not to participate in the debate, but sat down with former Fox News host Tucker Carlson for a pre-taped interview on X, the platform formerly called Twitter. Trump is averaging more than 50% support in national polls. Polling indicates Trump and President Biden are likely to be locked in a tight contest in a 2024 rematch. Leaders of the Democratic National Committee, as well as Biden-Harris campaign officials, spoke hours before the GOP debate. The committee's Jamie Harrison called every candidate who took to the debate stage extreme with radical positions.
"This group is as extreme as it gets. A bag full of MAGA apples, and they are all rotten.
They are wildly out of step with the American people.
The Republican National Committee released a video Wednesday promoting early voting and mail-in voting, a complete flip-flop from the last presidential election cycle when the party repeatedly attacked the voting practices. Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel came out in favor at the end of last year and encouraged members to embrace the move.
When Republicans vote early, we win.
Protest signs were back at the Tennessee State House Wednesday after a judge temporarily blocked a new rule advanced by House Republicans, banning them during floor and committee hearings. The ruling followed a lawsuit filed after state troopers removed three women Tuesday who held signs calling for gun control to protect children.
We have rights to hold a sign.
The Tennessee legislature is currently holding a special session to address guns and mental health. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
More than 95% of American schools, including those in Oregon, switched to remote learning in the spring of 2020 in order to slow the spread of COVID-19. Now, as Suzanne Potter reports, an analysis from House Democrats finds that teachers' unions did not have outsized influence on federal recommendations to close schools during the pandemic.
Democrats on the House Oversight Committee say a GOP probe into whether teachers' unions had too much influence on pandemic school closures has come up empty. A spokesperson for the Democrats says that, in fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention consulted a wide range of stakeholders before the American Federation of Teachers was even aware of the guidance to close schools. At a hearing in March, California Congressman Raul Ruiz, a Democrat, blamed the lengthy school closures on the Trump administration's attempt to minimize the threat of the virus.
Instead of working to efficiently manufacture PPE, scale up testing, and promote basic public health measures like masking and social distancing, President Trump chose to politicize this virus, calling it a hoax and downplaying its severity.
Republicans said students suffered trauma during the period of remote learning and alleged teachers' unions prolonged the return to on-site classes. In a statement, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said the right wing's attempt to blame educators and their unions for the effects of the pandemic was both wrong on the facts and a callous undermining of the very people who tried to help children and families in their darkest hour. Virginia Gentles with the Education Freedom Center and the Independent Women's Forum testified at the same hearing, alleging that school administrators knew that school closures were ineffective at preventing transmission of the virus, but went along with the closures for fear of crossing the unions.
Many feared the political consequences for prioritizing open schools. Let's be honest, schools stayed closed primarily because the teachers' unions in our country have enormous political power and parents do not.
Democratic Congressman Kwesi Mfume of Maryland criticized Republican members who focused on the negative effects of school closures but opposed funding for President Biden's American Recovery Act.
Many of my colleagues who sometimes seek to assign blame and suggest that there was some sort of weird evil plan in effect are the same persons who have a long track record of pushing draconian cuts to programs that support American schools and American children.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Some groups are training those charged with protecting 85% of the world's biodiversity, and a victory that in many ways is a dream that came true. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
In the heavily indigenous country of Guatemala, indigenous citizens hold high hopes for the upcoming administration of their newly elected president. Maria Martin has this report.
Maya anthropologist Irma Alicia Velasquez de Martuch shared in the nationwide euphoria after the upset landslide victory last Sunday of Reform candidate Bernardo Arevalo.
In many ways, this is a dream that comes true.
For indigenous people, she says, there are now hopes for a different Guatemala, one in which the Maya and other indigenous peoples aren't marginalized and treated as second-class citizens.
This is the opportunity to change the reality, to stop the migration to the United States. This is also a special moment for indigenous women. Indigenous women in Guatemala have been working very hard for justice.
Velasquez herself has suffered threats for her work as a columnist in the now-closed newspaper El Periódico. Her hopes for change are tempered by the reality of a Guatemalan system still trying to block Arevalo from taking office.
We know that Arevalo has many challenges, but we also recognize that it's possible to start to change and to build another Guatemala.
Maya Quiche anthropologist Irma Alicia Velasquez de Mantuch has taught at Stanford and other U.S. universities. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
There's plenty of conservation work to do on tribal lands, but it's not always easy to get Indigenous people into those positions. But groups such as the Forest Stewards Youth Corps see the value of working with them, and it's made an impact on the community. Emma Vandenindy with KUNC has more.
Chaz Robles is the director of Ancestral Lands Conservation Corps, another conservation group focused on recruiting Indigenous youth in the Mountain West, like the Forest Stewards Youth Corps. He says investment in youth training programs is critical.
So reconnecting those young folks to those places and spaces is a really powerful opportunity for those young folks to really find a passion for the outdoors and the lands and the waters that their ancestors inhabited.
And that passion is being pursued. 30 people from Jemez Pueblo have already gone through the Youth Corps programs. And of the 23 people who served on all of the crews this summer, 12 said they are pursuing or plan to pursue a career in natural resource management. Kyla Magdalena had a similar experience. She expected to go to work straight out of high school until she fell in love with tree plot planting.
It was kind of like a scavenger hunt because they would just give you like the map and the coordinates.
Now, she wants to study geographic information systems.
That really inspired me. So like, I plan to get my degree and come back to the community and help out with land.
That's paramount for people like John Galvan, the tribal forest manager for Jemez Pueblo. He says the work doesn't get done without the trainees' help. He gives them all the same advice.
Go out and explore the world. I will see what's out there and get your education, but do come back again to help our people, our community, our landscape.
Galvan hopes that more Indigenous people will take up conservation and use their knowledge of the land to help preserve it for years to come.
That's what it comes down. What are we leaving up for our future generations? So it's great to have these kids that are interested right now. Hopefully we can direct them to become foresters again, hydrologists or any geologists again.
For National Native News, I'm Emma Vandenindy.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 24th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Michelle Coppola, Mel Gertoff, Reed Johnson, Brett Pevedo, Suzanne Potter, Mark Richardson, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, coming up next.